Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Oh man, just me and you. I think this was the original Weird Things podcast. There is some version of this podcast in the very proto early phases where it was just me and you, and we immediately realized that we needed another voice and got Brian. But maybe the second time's the charm.
Yeah, I think it was because I had like three topics I wanted to talk about, and that was kind of it. And so let's expand a little bit. But now we're back. We can talk to those same topics. Man, I just sent you an email, and I want you to take a look at this. And what this is, it's a paper that just came out called 3D Photography Using Context-Aware Layered Depth in Painting. I know it's a very sexy title. What this is there's a big thing right now going on in image research where you take an image, like a 2D image, or in this case now a 2D image which has a depth map, like what your iPhone can take, okay? And then trying to figure out what's behind it. Now, the AI doesn't really know what's behind it, but it will guess. And if you train a computer, an algorithm, on thousands of images, hundreds of thousands of images, it's pretty good at guessing. Like, if I showed you a photo, you know, of a couple of people standing around in front of a building, and I asked you to guess, could you paint in the back of the building and everything else? You could make a pretty good guess of what it looks like. Not what it really looks like, but what it looks like. You follow?
Yeah.
So this paper is a new example of this, of using an algorithm for doing this sort of in painting. And it's exceptional because what they're doing is they're taking 2D photos that have depth data, meaning like your iPhone camera or whatever, Kinect. And then it goes in and it fills in background details. And we're looking at examples of there's a kid playing with a bunch of water, a water fountain, and we're zooming into it as the water is just spiraling away from the camera.
Yeah. So this, I think for people that look at it, it would probably most remind folks of some of the 3D photos, quote unquote, 3D photos that you'll see on Facebook or something, where that I think is a little bit more rudimentary, where it's just eliminating, it's using AI to eliminate foreground and background. And so therefore it kind of moves in a way where it's following your point of view. So it seems like it's kind of adjusting in the way that like a sign in a landscape as you're driving by does adjust to your eyes. But what we're seeing here, although it is evocative of that, I think the data is just in the same way that your phone can map out your face and stuff like that. Now being able to have all that raw data, you're able to do so much more so much more work in terms of separating planes of vision, right?
Yeah, and this is actually, and to Facebook's credit, this is sort of a more advanced. Facebook is one of the people involved in this paper, and it's Virginia Tech, National Tsinghua University, and Facebook. And so this is taking that, and what we're doing now is we're taking a lot of the neat stuff that we've seen before that shows promise and refining it and making it even better. And, you know, we're getting to the point like that. We mentioned the new iPad has LiDAR. That's a little laser on the back that scans a scene.
Yeah.
And as phones start moving towards that, when you take a photo, it's not just going to be a photo anymore. It's going to be a 3D map of everything in there. And then you'll be able to use computers and stuff we can do this already. Like we've seen with the iPhone with the front facing camera, you can take a photo of your face and you can change the angle of your face.
Yeah.
Post. With the depth data. And it's a crazy kind of world because we think the convergence will be AR and VR.
Yeah, this is the kind of stuff that we will be doing in AR and VR. These are the levels of data and granularity that will allow us to pop up, you know, some kind of overlay or alert over exactly what it needs to, because it's not just looking at a static image. It's looking at this, you know, tremendous depth of field set of data.
Yeah, and what's cool too is that you can take historic images and their algorithms to actually extract depth data. So if you click through a couple examples in there, you'll see there's a an Apollo 11 photo, the one that I think Buzz Aldrin or took of Neil Armstrong, and you see this image here of the astronaut. You see the moon behind him and all that. Now, that wasn't using a modern camera with the depth data. This was taking an image and processing it for depth data, then going back and using this algorithm to extract it. And so they show some really cool historical photographs of stuff that just, it's amazing to see these. Like, there's a photo of Mark Twain that's been colorized, and you see him sitting on a chair, and you're able to move around.
Yeah. I'm looking at all these now. There's, you know, the Queen of England and, you know, the moon landing. But all these things are, you know, you are filling in what is not there by way of AI, right? Like that's guessing what the back of somebody's head might have looked like as you are just seeing that peak of it as it moves around.
Yeah, there's an example here that is of these I guess you're looking at the historical photos, like and you see some just iconic photos that all of a sudden by adding that little depth data, it changes seriously considerably. Like, yeah, as you said, it's not real data. It's just doing a best guess because this model has been trained on millions of buildings, millions of details, and it's able to guess like you or I would, what's the rest of this here? You know, you're looking at Martin Luther King speaking to the Capitol Mall, you know, it's just incredible to be able to sort of look around and see these individual people there and whatnot. I think it's, this is where we are now. And we're seeing stuff too about the ability now to, there was another paper that came out last week, or there's some or update on this, which was mapping faces onto taking your face, your video, your live video, and taking a historic photo.
Yeah.
And we've seen versions of this before. We map it onto you, and then we found there's an even more improved version of this now where, you know, we can make you be anybody just from one photo, and these things could now come alive.
And that, I think that there's a few things that are kind of at play here from the human perspective. Number one, if you are allowing the AI to guess at these fringe elements of what make it a 3D image, number one, we as pattern recognizing creatures don't realize how many patterns we just kind of fill in our own head, right? Like, mm-hmm. like no one's going to look at these hairs that obviously look like kind of the back of this baby's head in the picture that I'm looking at right now and be like, those are fraud hairs. These are definitely created by a computer because we process so much information. But then beyond that, the idea of the surreality of a still image being a freeze frame versus how much does our brain need to see to immediately make it more lifelike? You know, is it color gradients? Is it the fact that it does have these like these rounded edges as opposed to being flat that just kind of take things to a whole new level in terms of how we think about it?
Well, yeah. And as you touched upon is that, you know, we're used to this already because when we reconstruct things in our mind's eye, what happened, it's not we don't have JPEG images in our head.
Yeah.
Our brain is putting together these sort of abstract ideas of what we think is going on. And, you know, it is the algorithms have become so good. And I'm going to send you another example here. We talked a while ago about remove.bg, which was a website that is useful for removing backgrounds from images that doesn't use any kind of like, you're not using, you know, a little Photoshop tool to go around and highlight something.
Yeah.
And you're not looking for a green screen. It's just been trained on so many images. They took tens of thousands of images that were separated from backgrounds done by people, I assume, trained it on that, and now you throw an image at it, and it does it. Now, the new version of this does this with video. And so if you look at the link I sent you, you can see they have a thing called Unscreen, where you just take a video of a person, and this isn't like your Zoom dot background where it's this really crappy sort of separation. This is like green screen level separation with moving backgrounds and details there.
Wow.
And even getting fine hair. Are you looking at it?
Yeah. So I'm looking at it now. And the lady who is the example is on a beach.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not, you know, her in any kind of studio. She's outside. But yeah, as her hair is blowing in the breeze, it looks as if she were on a green screen, and that the her being out in the desert sand was also one of those backgrounds. That's insane.
Yeah, I'm gonna see if I can pull up. I played with this actually. I was actually waiting at a doctor's office, and I found an example of this, and I don't know if
I'll tell you what. As you are looking for that, and we are trying to find an example of removing the background, we are probably remiss in stating why this is only the a Jury and Andrew show here today. We have some technical difficulties coming out of Austin, and they are fast at work trying to make sure that everything gets back up to snuff, considering how much content is coming out of that one little compound on the edge of Austin city limits. That is the priority right now. But we didn't want you guys to go a week without an episode, so we are here for you right now. And I'll tell you what, if Andrew's still looking for the video, it might as well remind you that patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support this show. Just head on over there and make sure that you get your custom RSS feed. That means that all the After Things podcasts that come in, they come to you first because it uploads right to your phone. I know that we've said this forever, but it never hurts to remind you that these custom RSS feeds, super easy. They go into any podcatcher, and once you've entered them in, there's no passwords. It is set it and forget it. That's all you need to do is put it into the podcatcher of your choice and just enjoy all of the Patreon content that you are now entitled to when you support us at patreon.com/weirdthings. Again, patreon.com/weirdthings.
So I just did this example. I'm sitting in front of a dark couple of dark things I blend in with, but you can see this video thing I made while you did that.
Yeah.
A full digital background removal. And if I was behind a more chaotic environment, and again, that's like, I know for videos and making movies and stuff, that's going to be a game changer because you do not need a green screen anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and, would you start adding that in with using depth data and stuff like this? It's a very, very, very interesting era, and it's trying to figure out like, where does this all go? You know, what, you know,
well, and also it's like, you know, you think about what you are able to do on the equipment that you have, right? When so much of this is cloud based, so you don't need the processing power that you would normally need it at some kind of, you know, ILM or Pixar, you know, the top of the food chain in terms of special effects. Now you can shoot 4K video on your phone. You can have this depth data, at least in the devices going forward in the very near term, and then use cloud processing for some of this stuff that, like, you know, in the past would be impossible to extraordinarily expensive, like frame by frame painting out of stuff. That's nuts. That's crazy.
I've been spending a little more time playing with VR. And, you know, a couple days in a row, I've been doing, like, using Beat Saber and some other stuff to exercise with.
Yeah.
And I found, you know, when there's a reason to go do it, it's extremely useful and it's fun and it's interesting. And part of the thing, though, is, like, there's the content problem. Creating 3D content's challenging. Like, I played, there's a fun, it's like a $10 game, Thrill of the Fight. Have you seen this?
No.
It's a boxing game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you go spar and then you train, you fight against a guy. And the mechanics on it are really good. The mechanics on it are quite good. You know, the boxing mechanics are good. You get into it as heck of a workout. The graphics are basic. Like, you look over off the ring and you see like five women standing in a row. They're the same exact woman with, you know, wearing just different versions of the outfit, all moving in the same time. And it's really creepy and they'd be better off without it.
Yeah.
But the problem is if you're this game developer, you're a small little shop and you're like, hey, let's come up with a cool game. We can get our mechanics and all that. Now you got to go in and go do all the other elements, all this other stuff. And what's cool about this technology is that, you know, you could theoretically take, you know, and not too distant future, you might be able to go to like Shutterstock, grab some video footage of a crowd.
Yeah.
3D map it and then create a depth map and put these 3D crowds around you that are still low poly, low polygons, which not going to be too intensive. I think that's going to be a big application, is we're going to start making 3D environments and stuff, you know, that feel extremely realistic because, you know, you can do this now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, the idea, I guess even the concept of being able to parcel out which fields you're seeing and how that aids replication is just nuts.
Yeah, absolutely. So very cool developments, you know, and it's just, it's happening very, very fast. There's so much stuff just going on that it's, you know, amazing and a little bit frightening too, to kind of think of what the implication of this could be. So I sent an article about Don Curlin. I don't know if you saw this yet. And Don Curlin has the distinction of he owns the world's most advanced private air force. He owns, just bought 46 F-18 Hornets. He's got MiGs. He's got all kinds of other amazing planes and stuff. And I don't know if you've read it yet, but do you know why he has these planes?
No, I have not read it. Although, if you wanted an escalation to Tiger King, this would certainly be one of them. But no, why on earth does this man have the world's largest private air force? Again, I repeat for everybody listening, a private air force,
and we mean with air fighters with fully operational machine guns. He's got these pods, like the tactical pods that are able to do, you know, as far as like, you know, throwing off false signals, et cetera, jamming, all that kind of stuff. He's got tactical pods. He's got machine guns. He's got all of this. And these are state of the art too. Like what'll happen is, let's say Canada was upgrading to like the new fighter. So he made a deal to buy the 46 of these and whatnot. So you read this like, man, is this guy just trying to be the coolest guy in the world? And, you know, you can get permits for machine guns and stuff, by the way, if you have a legit reason. And he's got like 18 permits for machine guns and stuff. Here's the reason. And once you hear it, you go, oh, yeah, of course.
Because I cannot right now think of a reason why. I mean, because this is the example, right? Whenever you get into like gun control arguments, it's always like, well, you wouldn't be able to buy a bazooka, right? You wouldn't be able to buy a Sherman tank. This dude has an Air Force. He's got an entire fleet of killing machines.
Yeah, and those things you can do with proper permitting if you have a reason to do it. You remember, bazooka manufacturers get to own bazookas. So
sure.
Clearly,
yeah, no. I know. I mean, I'm just saying. I have no idea even where that stuff starts. So please give me the real reason.
I'm just sort of saying the thing people often don't think about is like, you know, do you think that people make M16s? They got to be able to test these things.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
You know, not a gun control thing, but just a thing to think about. Like, this is like there's a very big industry of like doing this sort of stuff. So anyhow, he's got, bought stuff from South Africa, whatever. And, the reason is very simple.
Why?
When the Navy or the Air Force or Air Commands want to do drills and they want to test against other fighters, against other airplanes, his company is the one they go hire. And so if they want to do war games and they want to test out like, hey, how can we take down some other fighters and stuff, they use his.
Holy crap. So he's basically the practice squad for the militaries of the world. Like, if you just need to be testing against people that you do not, like, you don't have control over and you have not trained, these are the people that you call?
I think for us, you know, primarily for our allies. So, yeah, he's the guy that very often what they do is, because the military would like to, they want to be able to test stuff and all that, but the idea is that maintaining these fleets and keep them going can sometimes be challenging, even for the military. So that's what he's able to do, is he's able to provide it for, you know, the military. And I've heard, you know, people like, oh, like, you know, read it for malls. It could be for movies. I'm like, that's a, you know, they're only doing a one Top Gun, you know, every 30 years, you know. This is, you know, the military, how they will spend millions of dollars to do these sorts of things to remain, you know, have their tactical advantages.
I would also imagine that it does bring up kind of a awkward point where it's like, you can't just throw these away, right? Like, these don't just like go in the trash when you have old planes that you don't have much use for or doesn't meet your modern specs. So it probably helps to have places to sell these items as well as being able to train with them.
Yeah, in some cases you have some, you know, you have some aircraft and that you can't sell. Like when you make a deal to buy from, let's say, you know, the US, let's say Canada buy these, there might be a list of approved countries or whatever who can buy it from them or whatnot. And sometimes maybe they can't, or there's not available to, or, you know, financially, et cetera, they're looking to buy something else. There's not always a market for that. And here it's, you know, for some of these things, it's just a very good use of it.
Man, that's crazy. But meanwhile, this guy just gets to be the cock of the walk with his own private Air Force. Where is he's in Quincy, Illinois, it looks like, here in this article. So he's just here in America, just chilling out. Like he's the Joe Exotic of F-16s.
Air USA.
Air USA. Yep. Don Kirkland, man. What a guy. This. Yeah. Nuts.
Funny story. When I was a kid, we had a friend of the family, this guy named Walt, who had a Panzer tank that he'd refitted with like wheels.
Okay.
And he would drive it down the street. And so there's like a funny photo of my dad, you know, driving down the street in this Panzer tank, right? Like license plate Panzer, right? And the two things I know about Walt are, one, that he had a Panzer tank. Two, remember when there was this iconic video of when this whale washed ashore in Oregon and city officials decided the best way to get rid of it was to blow it up?
Of course, yeah. That was an original viral video.
I just lost your audio there.
That was an original viral video.
Yeah, they did that, and you see all these whale chunks starting to drop everywhere.
Yeah.
One big piece like went on and like caved in the roof of like a station wagon or a car. That was Walt's car. That was our friend's car.
Oh my God!
Caved in by whale blubber. So it's like, cool universe. Yeah, it's cool you have a tank. You know what else? Whale blubber on top of your car.
Exactly. Oh my God, that's crazy. Yeah. So this was in, for if you have not seen it, Florence, Oregon, in November 1970, the Oregon Highway Division, now the Department of Transportation, blew up a decaying sperm whale with dynamite in an attempt to dispose of its rotting carcass. The explosion threw whale flesh over 800 feet away. An American humorist, Dave Barry, wrote about it in his newspaper column in 1990 after viewing television footage of the explosion.
Yep.
That's insane. An example of a spontaneously busting whale carcass occurred in Taiwan in 2004 when the buildup of gas inside of the decomposing sperm whale caused it to burst in a crowded urban area while it was being transported for a postmortem. So that do not be confused. That was a naturally occurring exploding sperm whale in Taiwan. The 1970 exploding sperm whale was done the hard way with dynamite and grit.
Yeah, my favorite part about that video is the first the boom, the ooh, and the last thing I want to share with you, I sent you this video of these mysterious objects filmed flying by the moon.
Now, I saw this. This went around. And obviously, look, we are in a very bizarre time. We're going through a pandemic. Many of us, 90% of America at the very least, is under some kind of shelter or stay-at-home order. There's a lot of free time on the internet, Andrew, and that can only mean that we are finding the weirdest and most bizarre stuff. So if I can describe this for people as the video is happening, you can hear it a little bit here in the background, but it is the surface of the moon, a very high fidelity telephoto lens. You can see some kind of haze in the front, but the real money shot here is you can see what looks to be something kind of crossing the surface of it. There is some sort of like, it's even hard to say from the original point of view, but when you really zoom in, you see these, they almost look like little white mealworms that are casting some kind of shadow over the surface of the moon. Now, my immediate thought scientifically is ghosts, but where do you go?
Interdimensional travelers, man. No, I mean, it's fake. I saw this and I'm like, oh, of course it's fake. I mean, because you're I'm going to explain my theory today about how we know a thing is fake. Most simple, and particularly something like this. One, obviously, yeah, can't just say, oh, it's so extraordinary, clearly it's fake. But you also get in the circumstances like, so this guy was just watching the moon, just happened to see it, and everybody else has ever been looking at the moon. All the places have telescopes on the moon. Nobody else caught this.
Yeah.
And also, nobody in the community thought, oh my God, this must be real, whatever. And it was, we know how easy it is to create this stuff now. There was a time when the idea of VFX seemed a little more challenging, a little more difficult. But you look at this, you're like, oh, this is an afternoon's worth of work. And then the sound and all the other stuff like this. You're like, oh, that's cool. I'm like, oh, that's a pretty cool thing. I never once when I'm like, oh, I wonder if this is real. I'm like, oh, that's cool. We know we have a better idea when things are real now because a million people don't retweet the same thing. You get a million versions of it. When SpaceX had a couple of their launches, and we had the dusk launches that freaked people out in LA,
yeah,
because of the plumes, looked like this. When we had a Trident missile launch off the coast of California at another time, which nobody knew when it was launching, whatever. And there was a week of like conspiracy theories and like, ooh, what's going on? And I had friends that are like, love conspiracies and don't love, let's say, facts. Or like, well, is it really? I'm like, yeah, we have Trident missiles. We test them. This is a thing we do kind of thing. And so when it comes to photographic stuff, anything that's on a large scale, if you're only getting one source or just a couple things from one person, it's like, all right, I'm not.
Yeah. So what you're looking for in a video like this, if let's say it were to be real, you would want this to be the highest fidelity version of something that many, 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 many people have observed in some other kind of way, mm-hmm. right? Like you want that to be the tip of the spear that is backed up by many, by a huge redundancy, as opposed to it just being the only, oh, I guess I was just the only one that caught the fat ghost worms, trawling the moon.
Yeah. And you want to balance your skepticism too. And I remember when the Russian meteor happened.
Yeah.
A friend of ours at the very initial reaction was like, ah, oh, it's going to be PR. It's PR. It's not real. It's PR. I was like, oh, and they're like, no, it seems pretty legit. Like, no, you could have several people upload videos and stuff like this. And I'm like, no, I think this is real. Cause like meteors are real. We've caught air bursts and stuff before to get it during the day. Like it's real, but and then finally like, oh yeah, no, it's real.
So I guess part of it then, if you are interrogating this, is like, let's go ahead and take the Russian meteor thing. That makes sense because A, you're right. It's a natural phenomenon that does exist, right? Very rare, and certainly rare in the kind of way that it showed up. But then also Russian dash cams exist. This is not like a thing that's being invented in the way that this guy who would theoretically just be pointing his camera, his insane camera at this picturesque side of the moon might do.
Yeah, exactly. And not to say there can be specific events and rare phenomena and stuff that only one person's there to capture it. And I guess my point is when it's something sort of big or this big or whatever, now if only one person says, hey, I got this footage. Yeah, I know. I happen to be the only one that had my camera here, whatever. Huh? It's like, well, our threshold of proof just way the hell up, particularly because we have so many cameras and so many things that can capture stuff now. So,
yeah, I mean, I guess is that the thing is like, do we know it's real because in the first 30 minutes, more than 30 people upload a similar thing or at least like, make note of it? Because I feel like this would even be different if there were a couple of scientists that in real time were like, hey, did anybody else see the weird ghost worms on the moon? Like it would feel, it would feel more real even if there was not other evidence, but more people contemporaneously pointing out that there was some weird phenomenon.
Yeah. And not to say that we always got to keep an open mind about these things, but we're in an environment where there are more people and more tools and technology now to try to convince us otherwise that you sort of have to be like, yeah, the threshold of proof went up considerably now.
Yeah, I guess also it's like if we began this conversation, this podcast talking about how easy it is to use like off the rack your phone and cloud processing to create your own. I mean, like, you know, if it's now feasible to create a Jurassic Park-esque kind of cinematic experience using your iPhone and tools that you can find either free or readily available on the internet, then yeah, maybe for extraordinary footage, we have a bit of a higher bar.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that I kind of try to sound a little bit of the warning about when it comes to kind of the new age of fakes and stuff is we historically we go like, yeah, we've always had Photoshop previous before, but that was involved, you know, we think, well, we know how to handle this, but it's like, well, we understand if we see something in the newspaper on Twitter that gets circulated, but now we live in an age where it's going to be so easy and quick to reproduce these things. You could have bots making a million fakes, a billion images to do things. And also when they want to target you, you know, when we mentioned before, the technology exists right now for me to mimic Brian's voice, your voice, you know, anybody's voice who's got voice on the internet, that exists right now. And so I've seen really good examples of this. So what happens when you get the voicemail that's like, hey, Brian, hey guys, it's Brian. I need your help right now. You know, can you cash at me money right now because I got a parking ticket? I got a ticket here in Fresno and, you know, I'm stuck, you know, or whatever. I mean, that's the problem we live in, is that we haven't seen these sorts of fakes in a sophisticated way aimed at us individually.
Yeah.
And that's going to be scary. You know, you're going to, I had a problem because I had one of my credit card companies. I got, you know, hey, we have a charge war, you know, there's a charge problem here. Call this number. And I look at the number and I can't find the number on their website.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is their real number or not. And then I go, you know, I'm like, all right, let me see. I call the number and the number, they're like, oh yeah, just enter in your credit card number. I'm like, I'm not entering my credit card number into an alert that's presumably from my bank when I can't verify that this is their phone number.
I had the same thing. Yeah. I had the same thing with my bank. My bank had, they called me from some unlisted number and they're like,
yeah,
hi, this is our fraud protection thing. Can you please tell us your like last four digits of your bank thing or your social security number? And I'm like, no to both. No, I don't want to just be telling every unlisted number this kind of information.
Right. And so I'm like, no. And then my card got a hold put on it. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do? I'm doing my part. I remember all those warnings you told people, like, don't respond to this from, you know, sketchy things or unknown things. Done. But, you know, they failed on their end because, like, the number I'm trying to call, is it listed on their website? Is it there? And also because, like, I know they don't like to list numbers on websites now, you know, because people want to call and they don't have to do customer service. And it's like, I immediately switched after that problem. And I had all of a sudden, I'm getting all these services are getting shut down. I'm getting like, oh, you didn't pay this. I'm like, that was all an auto pay with that card.
Yeah.
I immediately switched everything over to Apple, over to the Apple card. Because Apple card, I open up the app, I can chat right there and say, what's going on? Help me out this. They built it into the phone, into the little app. Everything is inside of there. And I'm like, these other people, like, screw you. You've made my life difficult. I'm worried about like storage units now going unpaid and having my stuff there because they couldn't get their fraud thing together.
Yeah.
And I can't trust them in the future.
And also, yeah, that is the thing, not to get all into like, you know, security problems in the modern era, but I would feel a lot more comfortable if there was just a dedicated VOIP thing from my app. Right. That it's like you want to get in touch with this. You have an alert from my bank or my credit card. Like it's through the app. If I need an issue, if they need to reach me, they can reach me through the app as well as an email that could connect me through it. But if I'm on the phone, I would much rather do that.
Well, I think that's where we're going to. I've mentioned this before. My thinking is that one of the services we're going to be paying a lot of money for, or not a lot of, but we're going to be paying for or willing to pay for, is trusted stuff like that. And, you know, I keep using Apple as an example because, you know, I trust Apple. You know, I don't think Apple does everything well. You know, I think that a lot of their cloud stuff is problematic, and I have issues with some of the things they do, but I do believe that security is a very, I think they take it more importantly than anybody else. Not to say as important as they should, But, you know, and that's why, like, I went to the Apple Card because I know, well, that's their brand. They're trying to build their brand around security. Google may say it, other companies may say it, but in the end of the day, they're trying to sell advertising.
Yeah. And that's ultimately, yeah, I mean, part of the reason why music changed was because people trusted Apple with their credit cards and they were used to spending, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of dollars on equipment. So when they asked you, hey, would you like to buy an album for $10? You're like, oh, sure. I mean, you already have my credit card. Yeah.
And I see a future where this is a space that Google will get into. I think Microsoft will get into too. I think that they're, as they realize, oh, wow, people are, you know, PayPal, you know, was a very successful company because, and then became part of eBay because people wanted to buy things on the internet. And we've seen companies like Stripe and Square come along too that would say, oh, when there's a trust issue, how do we solve that? And I think we're going to go through kind of a new era of that. And I think the idea of secure lines of communication, and I think that's open to anybody. It doesn't have to be Apple that does that. You know, if Google years ago, they bought a company. Remember Grand Central, which was the company that was giving out like
That was the basis for Google Voice.
Yeah, anybody could get a phone number. You could get a phone number there, and it would process your, let you do voicemail, all sorts of really cool stuff with it. And when Google bought it, there was the talk of like, is Google, this is before the Android phone, like, is Google going to create like a free phone service? Yeah. You know, is Google going to make a free phone? Is Google going to revolutionize that? And that was the hope. It didn't happen. But there still is the idea, though, of, I love FaceTime. FaceTime is one of the most secure ways to talk there is, but it's limited to Apple devices. It's limited within the Apple ecosystem. And it's not a practical solution in the real world for business and stuff because you can't expect everybody to talk to use FaceTime, and it has limited features. And I could see a world with, you know, a secure channel sort of product.
You know, I think it would certainly be something that I would like for many companies that handle extraordinarily sensitive parts of my existence to take on, because the way it is now, you know, you're able to on at least the newest version of iOS, and I'm sure that this is probably something you can do on Android as well, but you can only accept phone calls from people that are in your address book, which has been tremendous when it comes to spam calls, as telephones in general become haunted tech. Where so much of your interaction is with automized spam calls, I set it initially to address book, and that was fine, except for whenever I wanted to get takeout, whenever I wanted to get Postmates or Grubhub or anything. Now I would always just get a automatic voicemail because these people are trying to call me to get information on coming to my door. Man, would I love if I wasn't just getting random phone calls, if there was some other point-to-point secure way that I knew I was talking to exactly who I knew I was talking to, and I wasn't just giving information on where my house is to a random person from a random phone number that I don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah, I agree. All right, you want to do some picks?
Yeah, I'll do a pick. So this is a repeat pick that I've already half done, and that is the first season of The Crown. This is on Netflix, obviously. It's an award-winning show. It is something that I didn't know whether or not I loved or hated. It is extraordinarily well shot. The melodrama of life in life amongst the royals, I think, at times can borderline on parody. I think I mentioned on this show that there is indeed an entire episode where the queen is very, very vexed, and the problem she has to get over in that episode is that she is stupid and she's been kept stupid. That is the hurdle she has to clear, is realizing how stupid she is. But I will say that as you get to the end of the season, there is some really, really good work done by specifically John Lithgow as Winston Churchill. And you start to get to a little bit more of the, what I think, I have more of a stomach for the Game of Thronesy, I need to make this decision and it's a personal betrayal of those around me kind of plots, than the like, will the British Queen ever wear a white hat? Let's spend 30 minutes arguing about it, right? And so it does get to, I think, the richer dramatic stuff where you are excited to enter this world as opposed to kind of wondering why we care about a show with such low stakes fights, you know, in this situation. So I came out of it with a thumbs up. The Crown season one on Netflix.
Yeah, I remember when I wrestled with the realization that I was stupid and will I always be stupid?
it's a whole episode. She's just like, oh, I've just now realized I'm extraordinarily dumb. And then she goes to her mom and she's like, Mom, why am I stupid? And she's like, well, it never seemed like it would matter that you learned anything.
I'm gonna have that conversation with my mom and see how it goes. I've got two picks, and one's sort of just a rehash of what I mentioned before. Is as we sit here, many of us, and you know, in isolation, you know, not everybody, a lot of people out there, you know, helping keep the wheels of the world spinning, and I'm very thankful for that. But some of us are, you know, stuck at home. I've been using my Oculus Quest a little bit more and more. And I found that, like, for getting the motivation to work out and stuff, like playing like games like Beat Saber is pretty cool, and Space Pirate Trainer is kind of fun. And, you know, spending 20, 30 minutes of some of those things, just keeping active, is great cardio. And it's sort of a different way to sort of break the monotony. And, you know, if you have VR with a few different games, you can sort of shift things up and stuff. Like, I don't have a lot of patience to sit there and do 20 minutes of the same kind of exercise every day. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, it's hard for me. But, you know, if you say, oh, go 20 minutes, listen to this song, or go do this and do that, that's different. That I can go do. And so that's been helpful. Second is an entertainment pick. And this is now available on Amazon Prime. And that is, I watched every single episode of the show when it came out, and it was one of these things where I was like, in all the seasons of it, and I mentioned a little bit before, where I was like, it's cool, it's good. It never, sometimes it got a little goofy, but overall I thought the writers were trying to tell a good story, and that's Stargate. And so there was Stargate SG-1, and mm-hmm. I just, you know, I saw Stargate Atlantis was on. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go watch Stargate Atlantis again and see how does it hold up, you know, almost like 15 years later.
Yeah.
You know, and I've got to tell you, I was really hopeful, like, when they brought back, like, they did, like, Star Trek Discovery, you know, yeah. When they were going to do, you know, Discovery and whatnot. And I was very frustrated by it because I thought that it was. And I'm not talking from a nerd who loves sci-fi thing. I'm talking from a storytelling point of view where characters did dumb things. Things were obvious in front of the characters and things like this. And it was just a very, you know, it's a style of TV writing where characters are dumb.
Yeah.
You know, they're dumb and they make bad choices just because you want to see the outcome of the choice and not so much think about why they did it. And I found that frustrating. And I thought that just it was a show that was a beautifully shot show. Like Discovery looks great, looks cinematic. Looks amazing. VFX are great. There were a few episodes in that were kind of entertaining, but overall, the characters were never making smart choices. They were making choices that were convenient for the writers to get to the plot that they wanted to get to.
Yeah.
With Stargate Atlantis, I've enjoyed it. Every night you get a little bit of that, but you get plots where, like, the smart people don't always get along, and sometimes they make bad choices, and sometimes they come across people who become their enemies because their enemies or have different agendas. And there have been several, you know, I've enjoyed it. I thought the writing of this was actually, you know, I'm looking at this going, oh, this is really good for TV. It's really good characters, really good. This is what I want to try to get done. This is what I need to get done. And, you know, they have examples because, like, in Stargate Atlantis, the premise is that, you know, they've gated into this new galaxy or Pegasus galaxy, which is actually this little tiny galaxy near the Milky Way, real place. And there, the bad guys are these sort of vampire-like creatures called the Wraith, and they go around sort of like every now and then, like, you know, sucking the life force out of people, as one does. And the problem was because the Stargate Atlantis people went there to this galaxy, they woke up the Wraith.
Ah.
And the idea is that, like, they can't just head home and run. They've kind of created this problem. And, you know, they encounter other groups of people trying to deal with it, and they come across this one group of people that are in sort of like this 1940s-level technology. And their plan is they want to make this sort of virus that will make the Wraith not able to steal their life force. and the Stargate people are like, hey, well, here's the problem. You know, they're going to annihilate you. They're not just going to leave you alone. You know, they're going to flat out annihilate you. And you see the point of view of the other people, though, like, well, we need to do this stuff. And it's not like always good guy, bad guy, which is what I like. I like this sort of like, we want to do this. We think this is bad. And, you know, the outcomes, I think, are interesting. So
there we go. Stargate. Where can you see it? Where can you see it? Where is it streaming?
So it's Amazon Prime. They've got original Stargate. They've got Stargate Atlantis and Stargate Universe. So they've got all of them. And again, it's a fun show. And I would put it up there with some of the best TV sci-fi. I think, you know, I think Battlestar Galactica is sort of the new Battlestar Galactica is sort of like, that's the highest mark. That was just consistently good. And I think Expanse is phenomenal. And I think if you're looking for something like an episodic with just a lot of stuff to dive into, I think Stargate for me, I've enjoyed that more than I've had anything, you know, called Star Trek since Next Generation. So just my thought.
Because we do have less people here and therefore you were going to get less picks, I will fill in with one more pick as well.
Okay.
And this one is a little bit, it's got a news peg to it. For those of you who do not follow political news, Linda Tripp died last week. And if that name sounds familiar, it is because obviously she was a huge part of the Monica Lewinsky scandal that led to the impeachment of Bill Clinton. She befriended and recorded Monica, and that eventually was the evidence that led to Clinton's impeachment. She, before she died last year, actually, I think it was 2 years ago, sat down for hours and hours and hours of interview with a podcast called Slow Burn. This is the season two of Slow Burn. They had initially done one about the Watergate situation, and they did another one about the Bill Clinton impeachment, and it's exceptional. Like there's a lot of podcasty documentary stuff that tends to make my skin crawl a little bit, but this was a great example of bringing you inside the creator's point of view on this, wherein he has a conversation with Linda Tripp, records her so we can have some reference of exactly what she said, not thinking initially that he was going to use it on the show, then asks her for a more formal sit down of to actually tape stuff, and she takes so long that now the creator has to think, well, do I use this audio of Linda Tripp on the show? And if there's anybody that, you know, morally, is it better that I would be using it of Linda Tripp, who, of course, surreptitiously recorded somebody else and changed her life forever? Linda Tripp winds up agreeing to the interview, as is evidenced fairly early on, because there's voluminous information from her. But it's great, and it is certainly important. I think, as somebody who followed this stuff and has read a lot about the Clinton impeachment, there's a lot of great color of where she was and from her perspective, why she did what she did. And now that she is gone, and, as far as we know, the closest that we will ever get between a reconciliation between Monica Lewinsky and Linda Tripp was Monica Lewinsky tweeting last week that she felt terrible for her family. Well, worth listening to. Season two of Slow Burn.
Yep. It sounds great. And not to get too up on a tangent, that's how you spot the compassionate people from the people who aren't compassionate. When somebody who maybe they disagreed with or had some grievance with or whatever passes, how do they handle it?
Yeah.
You know, when you dance on a grave, you know, people who dance on graves and stuff like this, unless it's like, you know, Pol Pot dies, you know, unless it's like, you know, and I mean, you got it clear, like there've got to be, can't just be like, well, they are involved in military. It's got to be like, there got to be killing fields, you know, got to be like, you know, and then there's arguments, you know, I'm on there. But any point is, it's like, I, you know, her thoughtful sort of, you know, Monica Lewinsky's thought response to that was like, this is a compassion. She's become a really interesting woman.
You know, and that's without getting too far into what is kind of discussed in Slow Burn, what you find from at least Linda Tripp's perspective and the perspective of some of the other people around, Bill Clinton and all the main players, was less that this was about, and even people who are very loyal to Bill Clinton, it was less that this was about what happened or that there was an extramarital affair, but more so at how young Monica Lewinsky was. And that really puts a different point of view, even if you're looking at how the world reacted to it. And people reacted like Monica Lewinsky was, you know, the sum total of all mistresses in the world and not this very naive, very open-hearted child, effectively, you know, that she had that perspective. And that from people that were around her, including Linda Tripp, that's how they looked at her, is that she was more of an idealistic daughter than she was an adult making her own or decisions that she would later be proud of. And there's a lot that goes into it. I'll let the series speak for itself, but Monica Lewinsky is somebody that, I mean, now that we all live in a world where we say, man, I don't know, is it really appropriate for us to be taking it this far on Twitter? And then you look at what fell around her head in the late 90s, just being the subject of derision and having your entire life defined by these mistakes these life experiences that you made. It's crazy to look back on, because boy howdy does she look far more like somebody that you should have sympathy for than the world on average gave her back when she was the most famous person in the world.
Yeah, there's always a person behind the headlines. There's always a person there. In this case, it was just, you know, I will have to say now, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.